was fortunate to graduate this past May with my PhD, and happy to now have that behind me, be able to take a breath and, you know, remember what life is like without having to read every night and write and all of that. So glad for that. I have a wife and two kids. Sadly, they're not here with us this morning, but though the kids I don't think would be very good in this classroom. They're very small, 3 and 1. They just had birthdays last week, and they're a great joy for us, and we're just pleased to have them. We live in Frisco and attend a small Baptist church up there, and feel fortunate to be able to be here with you this morning. So looking forward to our time together. This morning we're going to be in Psalm 40, but we'll get there in just a minute. We've got a couple of preliminaries first. I brought a prop, actually, this morning. Here it is. It's small, so I'm going to come up and I'll walk around to make sure everyone can see this fine thing here. Here we go. This, of course, this will not, I hope, be the best thing I say all morning. This is the number 3. The number 3, of course, has quite a number of significances in the Bible and in Christian theology. So I'll throw out one, and then maybe we can get some participation, and maybe you all can give me some as well. For instance, there were 3 friends of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that were thrown into the fiery furnace. How about some other 3s that we know from the Scriptures? Trinity, yes. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Wise men, yeah. Christ rose on the 3rd day. Other ones? Those are some good ones. Peter denied Christ how many times? 3 times? Lots of 3s. This particular 3, and the reason I brought this particular 3, has a very special place in our family that actually has nothing to do with the Bible, but I want to tell you about it. It involves the series of numbers that this 3 is a part of. My son received these a couple of years ago, and he loves these. I couldn't bring the whole set because I don't have enough hands, but they're the series of numbers and letters, the alphabet, and he lays them out, you know, with great care, in order, 1, 2, 3, A, B, C, and on it goes. And he'll get them out, and he does this over and over and over again. Great fun, apparently. And he enjoys this very much. Well, last year, my wife and I and our son, our daughter wasn't quite yet born. We decided we were going to move. And so coming around time to move, we decided we needed to take an inventory of the numbers and the letters. Because what the last thing we would want is to leave one behind, and now we'd have an incomplete set. And so we did an inventory, and happy to say they were all there. And so we put them away, and we said, okay, we're packing these away. We don't want them to get lost before we move. We got to our new house. One of the first things we got out was our numbers and our letters. And since we're sticking with the theme, let's stick with the theme. In about 3 weeks, we found that the 3 was missing. Nowhere to be found. And so my wife and I, we look at each other in a puzzled way, and we say, surely we moved, we did that inventory. It wasn't just my imagination, was it? We did this, and of course we confirmed to each other, yes, 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 we've done this. Okay. And so we looked. We looked under the couches. We looked under the refrigerator, and you know, the flashlight going back and forth. Nothing. So then we decided, well, we should ask our son, who was 2 at the time. Well, 2-year-olds are not the most informative people on the planet. He thought we were playing a game. Where's the 3, Nicholas? And so he would point to the couch. Well, we just tore apart the couch. It's not under the couch. Okay, so maybe it's at the refrigerator. No, no, no. We just looked under the refrigerator. It's not there. So he was no help either. And so we decided, well, we've looked. We can't find it. We know it's in this house somewhere. We know we moved it. We're just trusting that it's here. Fast forward 13 months to June, this past June. I got in my closet, pulled out my VCR, which we had put away many months ago, and was going to use it for something, slid the tape into the VCR, and if it had been an animal, it would have been a death cry that I would have been hearing. But this was, you know, a machine kind of version of that. And it was calling out to me to stop shoving this tape. So I pulled the tape out, and of course, electronics genius that I am, I decide, oh, I know how to fix this. I'll just open the slot and look in. And I looked in, and what do you know? The three. There it was. Our trust had been confirmed. We celebrated that day. I came out of the room. I said to my son, Nicholas, do you know what I found? And, of course, he had no idea. And I pulled out the three, and, of course, he was overjoyed. Now he could do his complete set of numbers. We didn't have to leave a hole in the row anymore. And now my daughter, who is just now becoming interested in these, will actually know what the number three is. She won't just have to believe us that there's a three. Yes, there's a three. And here it is. A bit of a silly story. But I think it it illustrates something that I want to talk about this morning and that I think is important in terms of when we come to Psalm 40. And that is the topic of faith. We believed that the three was there. We trusted that it was there. We had every confidence that it was there somewhere. And not necessarily every confidence we'd actually find it at some point, but we figured it was there. We believed it. And sure enough, it turned up. And this is, I think, a good illustration for us of the faith that David has and that he expresses in Psalm 40. And so if you'll look there with me, he expresses for us his own profound experience with faith. And we're going to read the first three verses here and spend a little time there to begin. David says, I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. David, writing the psalm, has cried out to God. He has, though, had to wait patiently, it says. Of course, the Lord does eventually answer his cry, but he's had to wait. I think this reveals for us, as we begin to think about this concept of faith and this concept of receiving faith, I think that, and expressing it, this reveals something very important. When we, as people of faith, turn our attention to God and we cry out to him and we ask him for deliverance from our trials, from our troubles, from our tribulations, we first have to realize that it might require us to wait patiently. God is not sitting in heaven waiting for us to snap our fingers and come running to our aid at the first moment when we decide, oh, you need to fix it this way right now. He's not doing that. He has his own plan. He has his own idea of how things are going to work themselves out, how he would like them to work out. And sometimes that means waiting. And in David's case, apparently, it meant waiting. For David, he waited well, he says. He waited patiently. God eventually did come. And God did hear his cry. And God took care of him. Of course, this experience of crying out is an experience that's common throughout the scriptures. All kinds of God's people have done this. And this is, I think, something that all of us can relate to. We've all had those moments, those dark times, when we've cried out to God, when we've asked him to come and help us, to deliver us. And certainly, as we, those of us who have accepted Christ, we've our first encounter with God was in that same vein, crying out to him, asking him, please God, to save us, to deliver us from the sin and the struggle that mars our life. And so this has happened throughout the scriptures, in Exodus with the Israelites. Nehemiah cries out to God and asks him to help his people. Hezekiah does the same. And so this is an experience that I think we have seen throughout history, and it's an experience that we can relate to as well. But David, in verse 2, uses some very fine metaphors, I think, for what actually occurs when God comes to act on his behalf. David is in a dark place. He says, he lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. These are not nice terms. David, of course, is not in a literal pit. He was not literally sinking in mud, but the image is evocative of the kind of struggle that David was experiencing at the time. He felt, covered in all of this muck of life. Whether that was of his own doing, whether he got himself into that circumstance, which of course we know from his story that there were opportunities for that, or whether others had put upon him, of no doing of his own, they came to him and did that. We don't know. The fact is, though, that he was in that place. He was in that dark place. And I think one of the things that I think is interesting about this, when we see the word pit, he lifted me out of the slimy pit. Pit is an image, I think, that's associated with death often in the scriptures. Psalm 30, I think, is a good place to turn for this. Verse 3, again, David, O Lord, you have brought me up from the grave. You spared me from going down into the pit. The pit and the grave here are compared. They're connected in David's mind. And so whatever David's problem is, it's related in his mind to this notion of death. And he's asked God to come and help him. And, of course, he's had to wait for God to come and help him. David couldn't get himself out of the slimy pit. And if you kind of picture this pit a little bit, you can see, how difficult it would be to remove yourself. A few weeks ago, I was watching a sporting event. And during this game, of course, they play commercials incessantly. They just go on and on. And when you're watching network television, they like to play the same commercials over and over and over again. So this one particular commercial is etched into my mind. It is of this apparently new reality show called Wipeout. Has anyone heard of this? Wipeout? Yeah. It looks amusing, I guess. But it involves putting real people into what we might call kind of extraordinary obstacle courses. And so one particular sad fellow, who this was repeated time and time again on this commercial, I don't know how he got chosen for this. I felt truly terrible for the guy. But part of the obstacle course involved him walking down this balance beam. And it wasn't any ordinary balance beam, though. It was a balance beam that on one side of it, there was a deep pit of mud and muck and just dirty looking water. And it would be hard enough, the pressure of the obstacle course, you're trying to make a good time, it would be hard enough to get across that balance beam intact, right? Of course, they had to add something else, and that is, on the other side of him, there were these looked like boxing glove or jousting sticks of some sort poking out at him, trying to knock him from the balance beam. Well, and you know what's going to happen, right? There he goes, into the mud. Well, the obstacle course isn't over. You got to get back up. You got to get back on the balance beam. You got to get onto the next obstacle. Well, of course, now he's covered in slimy mud, right? How is he gonna make it? Well, of course, he doesn't. And that's what's funny about it, supposedly. So you watch people fall over and over and over again. Slimy pits do not lend themselves to getting out of them easily on your own. You need help. If he'd had someone to guide him, to hold his hand, who didn't have all that sliminess, he could have made it right through. of course, he didn't. He was on his own. And so I think it makes a good illustration of what David here is struggling with. So he lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and the mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. The word pit evokes an end in death. The word rock evokes the opposite. I think it evokes a beginning. If you think to, for instance, Matthew 16, Jesus speaking to Peter and the apostles, and what does he say? He begins the church by setting it on this rock, right? This is the beginning. And David has been set on this rock. Of course, the rock being Christ, who whose message has been carried on by the apostles and faithful Christians since then. And so David has been set on this rock. He has been given a firm place to stand. And this is, I think, true of us as well. Those of us who have become believers, who have been delivered from the miry pit of sin and struggle. Not that we don't struggle now, but that we have the Spirit and we have the means to overcome and the hope of overcoming. And so we have been set on this rock. As believers, have been set on the solid ground of Christ and will be continue to hopefully stand and find our put our faith in that solid standing. Now, verse 3, he comes in and he says something very interesting, David does. He says, he put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. He uses the word see here. Many will see, it says. And this idea of seeing, David has been placed on the rock. He's been delivered. So what are these people seeing? They're seeing someone who's been delivered. They're seeing someone who's been rescued. They're seeing someone who's had a change in his life. He's gone from here to here. And so people see this. This, I think, is very important as we think about this idea of faith. That faith is something that God gives us in His timing. That faith is something that God helps to that God has to affect and bring to us and give to us. And He delivers us. But that faith is something that leads to, when we've been delivered, when we've been given faith, it leads to others doing the same. Why? Because our lives have been changed. Because no longer are we sinking into the slimy pit, but we now are set on the firm ground of Christ. So people will see this. And the response is fear. Now, of course, fear in the Scriptures is often, not a... what we would think of as sort of being afraid of the thief creeping up to your house at night. Fear is a term that connotes respect. People see changed lives, and it changes them. Because they realize, I think, when you see someone whose life has been changed, and it's unexplainable, it's miraculous, it's beyond something that you can affect in your own life, there's a respect that comes from that. You look at that and you say, that's beyond me. I can't do that. And so there's a respect for that power that that affected that change. And so David's life has been changed. Many will see, and they will fear. And what's the response? What's the result? They put their trust in the Lord. Faith comes from that. So faith breeds faith. David trusted in God to be delivered. He was delivered. Now he's changed. Others will see him and experience that change. The change leads to, I think, three particular... David goes on in the psalm to explain for us three particular changes that come as a result of faith. Faith leads to three particular things. And so I want to look at those with you in the next few minutes, starting in verse 4 of the psalm. First of all, in this section, verses 4 to 8, faith leads to doing the will of God. So David is trusted, he's been delivered, he's been set on this solid rock, and now this is what the difference that faith has affected in his life, that this deliverance has affected, these are the differences. First, it will lead to doing the will of God. Verse 4, blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods. Many, O Lord my God, are the wonders you have done, the things you planned for us, no one can recount to you. Were I to speak and tell them, they would be too many to declare. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have pierced. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. And then I said, here I am, I have come. It is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. Faith leads to doing the will of God. Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust. The result of making the Lord your trust is doing the will of God, which he comes to in verse 8. David's life has been miraculously changed. He has been delivered. He has been pulled from this dark place. He knows now where he needs to look. He says that he's not looking to the proud. He is not, as a person of faith, looking to false gods. Of course, a great struggle in Israel's history, and still a struggle at David's time. People worshiping gods that were not the true God. And David realizes that he called out. He's had this experience of calling out and being delivered, and he knows where that deliverance came from. And so he's not interested in turning his focus to the right or to the left. He's interested in putting it where it belongs, in the Lord. And so this, of course, helps him to see many things about the world, all the great things that God has done, the greatness of God. Changes that come in our lives as a result of God's work in our lives, I think in some ways are just unexplainable. We like to be able to look back and kind of articulate it and say, oh, well, I did this or I did that or this happened to me. And so we try to kind of explain certain things now I'm a more patient person because I did this and because this happened. So we kind of try to put some boundaries around it. And I think that's okay to a certain extent. But at a certain level, we need to be able to step back and we need to say there's a mystery here. There's a mystery of God working in my heart which is not good, which does not seek after God, but he works anyway, and the Spirit works, and he somehow affected this change in me. And I can look back in my life and I can see here and here and here are times when, those changes, I think, really evidence themselves. And so David looks back and he says, the things that you planned for us, no one can recount to you. He knows that there's no telling where his life is going to go. He can't see into the mind of God. Were I to speak and tell of them, they would be too many to declare. He's looking back. He's saying, look at all of these things that you have done for me. Look at all this that has occurred in my life. And then he comes to this very interesting section in verses 6, 7, and 8, which is quoted in Hebrews 10, actually, and referred to Christ. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have pierced. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. So David recognizes the true sacrifice here. The sacrifice is not an animal. That's not what God wants. The sacrifice is not some bread or some grain brought to the altar. This is not the sacrifice that God desires. David, having been delivered, And having waited patiently on God and trusted in Him, David realizes that the desire that God has for his life, and I think the desire God has for all of our lives, is not a desire of things or of, you know, outward necessarily, you know, simply outward expressions. What God desires is a heart that's turned toward Him, a heart that does the will of God. Faith leads to a heart that does the will of God. That's what it should lead to, at least. Where our focus, I think, should be, at least in one respect. Verses 9 and 10, faith leads to doing the will of God. Faith also leads to proclaiming God's goodness in the world. Verse 9, I proclaim righteousness in the great assembly. I do not seal my lips, as you know, O Lord. I do not hide your righteousness in my heart. I speak of your faithfulness and salvation. I do not conceal your love and truth and your truth from the great assembly. David's been delivered, and he's not going to be quiet about it. And I think the great example here is that the person who has recently come to Christ, they're very excited usually about this. They want to tell people about it. They want to talk about it to other people. And I think very often that newness, well, it's good for us. It's infectious. We see that and we say, that's right, that's good. God is good. And it's very easy for us to sit back and sort of confess that, and we come together every Sunday and we acknowledge that, and we'll sing songs about that, and we'll listen to good teaching about that. But ultimately, what God hopes for us and what God desires for us is for us to also proclaim that, certainly among one another, but also as we go out as well. And so faith leads to doing His will. Faith leads to proclamation. David says, I do not seal my lips. It's like he's not going to, keep his mouth shut about this. It doesn't matter where he's at. Doesn't matter who he's speaking with. This is going to be on his heart, on his mind, and he has particular things he wants to talk about: faithfulness of God, His righteousness, His salvation, His love, His truth. These are the things that that God wants us to speak about and to proclaim to one another and also beyond. So faith leads to doing the will of God. Faith leads to proclamation. Faith finally leads to continued dependence on God. This is what David expresses in the last several verses of the psalm. Do not withhold mercy from me, verse 11, O Lord. May your love and your truth always protect me. For troubles without number surround me. My sins have overtaken me, and I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head, and my heart fails within me. Be pleased, O Lord, to save me. O Lord, come quickly to help me. May all who seek to take my life be put to shame and confusion. May all who desire my ruin be turned back in disgrace. May those who say to me, aha, aha, be appalled at their own shame. But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who love your salvation always say, the Lord be exalted. Yet I am poor and needy. May the Lord think of me. You are my help and my deliverer. O my God, do not delay. Note that David has been delivered. Verse 2, verse 1 and verse 2. But apparently the troubles still come. Deliverance has come in his life, and he's happy to proclaim it. He wants to tell everyone about it. He wants to follow God. He's renewed. He's reborn. He's excited. And then more troubles have come. More enemies are at his door. They're waiting to take him out. He needs protection. He needs continued protection. For troubles without number surround me. They just keep coming. And I think this is true of us, too. We've been delivered. We've been set on the firm rock of Christ. But the troubles come. Financial strain, trouble in the marriage, various things that happen to us. Time and again, they keep coming. And it's always something else. You just think, okay, I'm just going to get to this one spot and it'll be all better. And then when you get there, what's waiting for you? Something else. Another trouble. Another struggle. There's not very many of those times when the peace just extends on indefinitely, you know? There's always something to deal with. Maybe it's in your own heart. Maybe it's a struggle with a family member or a friend. Maybe it's something that life is just throwing at your family. I don't know. We all know what those things are. And David here expresses that, and he expresses his continued trust in God. He knows God has delivered him. And so what does that cause him to do? That caused him to continue to ask for deliverance. God, I know you've done this before in the past. Please do it again. Please come quickly. Please, I need you. One of my favorite novelists is an old Russian guy called Fyodor Dostoevsky. Has anyone heard of him? Yeah. He wrote big, thick novels that are very intimidating, but are really wonderful. And Dostoevsky, I think, is very similar to David and the things that David's expressing in this psalm in this particular sense. If you knowing something about his life, I think will help to contextualize this. But he lived in Russia in the 1840s, which was a very difficult time. The government was very hard and didn't allow a lot of a difference of opinion, if you know what I mean. And Dostoevsky had just been discovered. He was kind of on the rise as a writer. And he was part of this little reading group. And at this reading group, people would come and they'd read things that they'd written, and they'd read other things that other people had written. And sometimes people would read things that were a little politically, uncouth, if you will. And apparently, Dostoevsky one time at one of these meetings read a letter that he didn't write, but somebody else wrote to somebody else. Person B wrote to person C, and Dostoevsky read this letter. And apparently it had some political content that was a little iffy. Well, word gets back to the leadership in the country, the government, and they arrest everybody in the group. And he goes to prison in April. In December, he learns that because of this letter, he has been sentenced to death for reading a letter. And they take him out of his cell, along with 20 other men who were also at this group, all of whom have been sentenced to death. And they take him to a scaffold in the town square. They put them all up on display so everyone can see them. And they take the first three. Dostoevsky was not one of the first three who stood up on the scaffold, but the first three, including the leader of the group, the organizer, they take down, they line them up, tied them to stakes, put hoods on them, and set the firing squad in front of them. And these military young men loaded their guns, and just as they were taking aim, a horse rides up from the Tsar, the leader of Russia, and he has commuted their sentences. No one's going to die today. Dostoevsky received 4 years hard labor. He had to go to Siberia, and he had to, work with a lot of hard people for a long time. The day he, after he got his 4 years and he finished, he had, of course, been overwhelmed that he didn't die. He had prepared himself. And when he didn't, he felt reborn, renewed, like he had new life. And he got to the end of his 4 years. And he had to go into military service for another four. And so he was still in Siberia. He didn't get to go back to his family, to his home. But he finished those 4 years. And these 4 years were the hardest 4 years of his life. He was alone, but never alone. He was a gentleman in a place where there were no gentlemen, and they mocked him and they scorned him, and they cast him aside. He had no friends for 4 years, but he was never by himself. He couldn't be alone because he lived in close quarters with prisoners. And so it was a terrible time for him. And when he got out, he wrote this confession of faith. It's a little bit, there's a few lines to it, so bear with me. He says, I will tell you about myself that I am a child of the age, a child of disbelief and doubt up to this time, and even, I know this, to the moment they put the lid on my coffin. Such awful torments I have suffered, and I still suffer now from this thirst for faith, which is always the stronger in my soul, the greater are my arguments against it. And yet God sometimes sends me moments when I am completely at peace. At those times I love, and I find that I am loved by others. And in such moments I have composed for myself a symbol of faith, in which everything for me is lucid and holy. So here's this way of expressing his faith. And here it is, he says, the symbol is very simple. It is this, to believe that there is nothing more beautiful, profound, loving, wise, courageous, and perfect than Christ. And not only is there not, but I tell myself with jealous love that there cannot be. He struggled, like David. He was in a miry pit, and he was pulled out, like David. And he knew the source of being pulled out. He knew how that happened, just like David did. And it changed his life. Wasn't a perfect man, and neither was David. Not even after the fact. David even says, my sins have overtaken me. He's still struggling. We still struggle. David suffered. Dostoevsky suffered. You suffer. I suffer. But what are we doing here? Are we people of faith? And what does that mean? Does that change our lives? Does that make us people who desire to do the will of God? Does that make us people who happily proclaim his goodness and his truth to others, amongst ourselves and outside of this room? Does that lead us to continue dependence on him? Or do we struggle? Do we turn away? Do we still try to take it in our own hands and work things out on our own? I think my experience is that too often we do. And I encourage you today, as you think about living a life of faith, focus on those three things. Desiring to do the will of God, proclaiming his goodness to others, and continuing to depend upon him as the struggles and trials of life threaten to overtake you. All right. Let's do some discussion.